family. My name's Ernie, and I am a very grateful recovery alcoholic.
I am.
My sobriety date is June 14th, 2004. And so every day after that, I am very, very grateful. I can promise you that. You know, I want to thank everybody that's responsible for bringing me out here, out to Vine College Station. I want to thank Leanne for giving me a call and giving me this opportunity to come out here and kind of bare my soul to my family members here and share the message what this program can do. I know following Mark Houston, you know, from last night, following Mark, you know, I listen to him and, you know, he's like the Lone Ranger. I'm feeling kind of like Tonto right now. You know, he's there, but his story is Mark's story. My story is Ernie's story. And I'm here for really because of one reason, because of free food. And that goes back 5 years ago. I was at the Roundup in Kerrville, Texas. And I didn't know Leanne, and we're walking along, and Chris Rainer was supposed to be cooking hot dogs around here someplace. And I said, are they free? And she said, yeah. And I said, okay, because at 50 years old and living in a halfway house and busted broke, free hot dogs sounded like filet mignon to me. And from that very moment, you know, when I was there, things began to change. I'm going to tell you real quickly, you know, about my story. You know, I'm not from Texas, but I have always rooted for one team in Texas. And at this time, I just want to say one thing: Giggum Aggies. But I'm from San Diego, California, and you know, my story is that I came from a wonderful, wonderful, loving family. You know, I grew up on right near the beaches, about 10 minutes from the beach, and I was a pretty good athlete. I spent every day with either in the water, water skiing or surfing or snow skiing or something like that. And God gave me a pretty good gift. You know, I could run. I was a pretty good athlete, you know, and we came to football or baseball. There were a lot of stolen bases involved. But I came from a wonderful, wonderful, loving family. From that basis of that family, I need to tell you what that family structure was like. I'm Greek, and so I know what this big, fat Greek weddings are all about. This big, loving family. And my father passed away just a year before I came to Kerrville and I got sober. And so as I stand here today, I feel my dad's spirit, that, you know, my father's life was not a waste, and that I have become the son and the brother and the nephew and the cousin, the employee and the friend that I could never, ever have been if it had not been for the fellowship of AA and what it has to offer in these rooms and the people in these rooms like we are here today. But my father, we owned grocery stores, and liquor was readily available because it was a liquor store also. But you have to understand that my father came to this country through Ellis Island from Greece. He couldn't speak the English language. He came here with 38 cents in his pocket, and he amassed a very comfortable living. And he worried about one thing: to give me and my sister a better life in life. And we had alcohol in the house, and the whole wall looked like a liquor store. And I can tell you via this, my father had two drinks a year, and he never drank when he was sad. He thought it was an experience that he had to have to help another individual when they were going through that, to learn from that experience and help that other person. And that's amazing. He was 12-stepping people, and he wasn't even in the fellowship. You know, my father every morning with my mom, they prayed every morning. They prayed before they went to bed. And now my mom, she was born in Antelope Valley in Lancaster in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And she didn't speak English until the age of 12. They were way out there, and they farmed alfalfa and ranched sheep and cattle. My mother's mom, my grandmother, in 1935, was killed by a drunk driver in the midst of the Depression. And my mom, in the middle of the Mojave Desert, had to raise her seven siblings. And after a year after my grandfather came back, somebody tried to start the stove, which surprised my mom. and they burnt the ranch house to the ground, and the only thing they had was the clothing on their back, and most of them were barefoot in the field. My mother's story was the grace of wrath. And my mom would tell me her story, and I would want to drink. I mean, it was something that she had. And my mom was like this. You know, we would go to a wedding, and she'd have her one drink a year. And she'd take 15 minutes to order it. It was always the same thing, old-fashioned. I'd like her to have a little bourbon, just a little bourbon, lots of ice, lots of water, a little sugar, a little bitter. Make sure you put a cherry on the top. And she takes two sips off this thing, and she slide it away, and she looked at me and go, "I'm starting to feel it." And I'm reaching for that drink, and I'm 9 years old. And she's saying, "You know, that's nothing for you, you know." But I don't know if it's genetic, a predisposition, if this is a disease that is harbored in the genes of my family. I don't know where it came from. You know, but they promise you, if they shook this tree somewhere, one of these our cartoon characters is going to fall out. And boy, I sure have it. There's quite a few members of my family that do. I'm Greek, and so alcohol was a lot of places. And so I remember having a couple of drinks and never really having that much of an effect on me. Now, I did drink once a couple times and lost complete control, but the thing is when I crossed that line is when I started to drink to change how I felt, that internal condition. Now, like I said again, I just want to tell you who I am. You know, I was an athlete, a lot of people knew me, my name was in the paper. You know, I could go just about anywhere, and I could go into a room like this, and everyone would say, "Ernie, and hey, how's things going?" And everyone knew me. And there was something wrong inside, you know. There was just this ill at ease, this irritable, restless discontent, that there was something going on. And people that know me, and I talked about this today, they said, "We never saw that. We saw this guy that was real confident, and was outgoing, and funny, and loved to run, and do all these things." But I remember the moment it happened. I was in high school. And I was at a party, and three girls that I was attracted to, and they were standing together. And of course, you know, that's the most mystifying thing in the world is women to me. They're soft, they're warm, they smell good. And so there were three of them, and I remember I took a can of Schlitz malt liquor, and I chugged about three quarters of that Schlitz malt liquor. That bull. And I set it down, and that alcohol hit my system, and I started heading right towards all three of them. And as I'm walking, I mean, I've got like the music from Mission Impossible going up, dun, 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 in my head. And I'm walking right towards them, and I'm thinking I'm James Bond all of a sudden. I'm 007. You know, I drive a Volkswagen, I think I drive a Ferrari. And I go up to the three of them, and I walk up to them, and I ask all three of them out at the same time. And now one of them said, "Ernie, you're crazy." And the other two said, "Yes." And I thought, hey, that went pretty good. So far, so good. And at that moment, I crossed into that area where I knew how to learn, how to calm my nerves, how to make me feel all right with the world. And there it was. You know, and this went on, you know, I grew up 8 miles from the Mexican border, so there were a lot of things that were illegally coming across the border. And if you hear alcohol, you have to really, when you hear me talk about alcohol, you need to have me think about also, can you please think about side issues also. There were things that came from Colombia. There were things that came from Peru. But we're not going to talk about that, but that was always a little identifiable for that, you know. And, promise me. And so, you know, I went through school and I got into college and, you know, my life, I was living out at the beach and things were going pretty good. And, you know, I continued to want to change how I felt. And that's the bottom line. And so, lo and behold, you know, I was placed in a state lottery in California, and I there were 18,000 people in this lottery, and they drew 11 names, and they drew my name. And I won a liquor license. And what was God thinking about that? You know, and so I had an opportunity to open my own liquor store. Okay, I'm going to give you this fact. You know, news alert, it didn't work out very good. And that's just the fact. But, you know, I had a cousin that I was very close to, that we were inseparable. That, you know, and he always lived in my shadow. And we partied together, fist for fist, and we were partners in his store. And we'd go out at night, and he'd come back and the next morning, and he'd go, that was crazy. And he immediately started to focus on work. And when I came back after that crazy night, I immediately started focusing on, can't wait to get off, can't wait to have my next drink. You guys identify to any of that? That obsession of the mind had started to kick in. And there was a time in my life when I had a wonderful girlfriend, and she got tired of my nonsense. She got tired of my wandering eyes. She got tired of the alcohol. She got tired of all the other issues that I was using at the time. And she said, Ernie, enough is enough, and she left me. And after about 10 years, you know, it broke my heart. And at that time, I crossed over. Whoop! And I could never come back. And my alcoholism and everything else, it just accelerated. And everybody in my family is saying, Ernie, you know, why can't you stop? And I'm like, I have no idea why not. But I try to pull it back with my relationships with people, with money, and I could never quite do that. And I try to do it with marriage. And because maybe if I get married, maybe if I marry the right person, maybe if I even marry the wrong person, I'll have a better self-will about who I am. And the store, you know, went away, to say the least. And I was married, and my wife was on the verge, and she had laid down some real ultimatums, and so I had decided that I was going to walk in, I was going to go get help, and I was going to get sober. No, you don't get sober. And so I was doing it. I had the house on the hill, the nice car, the nice job, it was all there. So, you know, you think it's outside stuff, but it's this internal condition. And I remember I've gone through, you know, I'm going to talk about treatment just a couple times, but I had gone through treatment, and came out, and I went from 90 meetings to 90 days, and on the 91st meeting, I decided I didn't need to go to have a sponsor. And so I started that with chipping away at my program. And I decided in a very short period of time, you know, I had problems with other issues, but I don't have a problem with alcohol. You know, it's just in a little silver can. I mean, my God, you know. And in a very short period of time, my life was once again spiraling out of control. So I remember, and I was sneaking it and hiding it and doing all the things I wasn't going to do. And I was stealing checks and lying and doing all those things that we do in the disease. And I remember I was home, and I got home early. My wife came home, and she was a court reporter, stenographer. And she came home, and there I was with a bottle crown. And she looked at me, and she said, oh, no. And she said, you relapsed. And I didn't even have any words to say. And she looked right at me, and she goes, you make me a drink and call your sponsor. And I just went, oh, yeah, this is why I love this woman. Because she's one of us. And needless to say, I made that drink and I never called my sponsor. And my life continued to spiral again out of control. I would rise to the highest levels of my positions, and no matter what I was doing, I always got to the top of the mountain, and I'd come crumbling down because of this disease and how it took me and where it took me. And so needless to say, I lost my wife, and she left. And you know, I didn't lose her, I chased her away. You know our story. So, you know, then there was, I thought I would do something different, you know, in my life. That I was going to do something that maybe I can control my drinking or my using. And so I took off for Hollywood. Now, that is a good thing. Don't work in Hollywood, you know. So I did that for quite a few years. And they allow you, it's like the Peter Pan syndrome. You don't have to grow up. You know, if they want you to get hired on some of the jobs I was on, you had to have an arrest record. You had to have a 502. You were supposed to drink at work, afterwards. And there were people to drink normally, but nobody drank like me. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter how beautiful the women were that I was working with, how much money I made, how wonderful the studios were. It didn't matter because that phenomenon of craving, and I don't know when it's going to happen. That's the kick. Because this is it. I had been through treatment and diagnosed with this disease by my friends, by my family, but not by myself. So I would get off work, and after a long thing, they'd all go out to the bar, and I'd sit down with that Corona. And I'd have that Corona and that lime down the middle. And I'd have that one beer, and nothing would happen. And I'd go home. And they were all shocked. They're like, they called me Coach. And they're like, Coach, are you going home? I'm like, yeah. And for some reason, that one beer would satisfy that phenomenon of craving. And that was it. And I went home, and nothing happened over the weekend. And Monday, I was early to work, as I always do, I guess. And nothing happened. I didn't steal any checks. You know, I didn't write any bad checks or, you know, borrow money from people that didn't know I was borrowing it. That, with the promise of, I'm going to pay that back. But then the next week would come the insane thought that the experiment last week worked well. I'm going to try it again. Why not? I've got this wonderful memory. I'm unable to recall the terrible, terrible things that have happened to me with my drinking and using. You know, I was in a car accident. I spent 6 months in a body cast. They put 87 stitches in my face. I'm not able to recall that. Because I did some distance on that event about 8 years, and now I'm just in Hollywood making money and I'm just going to have a beer. Any normal person would stop. But that's not my case. And so I have that one beer again, that one Corona, and bam, that phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I am off to the races. And it is 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're telling me, you have to leave. And I'm like, okay, and then in a very short period of time, I'm waiting for the liquor stores to open come Saturday morning. Now, I need to tell you this real quick. My father, I work, if you've ever flown into San Diego, my father's store is you fly right over going into Lindbergh's Field. It's on the corner of First and Ivy. And a gentleman, a Mr. Potter, every Sunday would come in when I was young, and every Sunday he'd walk in with the exact same chain, bam, and he'd buy a paper, and a pint of pop-off vodka. And I said, good morning, Mr. Potter, how are you? And I was a young man, I was 16 years old, whatever, and he wouldn't say a word. And he'd get that, he'd put it in the bag, and he'd walk outside, he'd open it up, and take a hit off that thing, he'd close it, put it in the back of his 62 Fairlane with a little dot lights on the back. He'd make the only one you turn and go up the hill. And I thought to myself, what a miserable existence. What a miserable life. Now, you fast forward 30 years, and Ernie, working in Hollywood, I'm sitting outside that liquor store at 8 o'clock in the morning waiting for it to open. And I'm thinking to myself, these guys are blowing it. Dylan's in business. I mean, if I own this liquor store, I own a liquor store, I open it every day. Never on time. But. And there's cars going by, and I'm the only one waiting there. And it didn't dawn on me on how far down I had gone. So this continues to go on, and you know, I am fired by. I was asked to take a hiatus from a studio. Oh, no, I got fired, and I was let go. And you know, it's funny. I could do. You know, so I'm gonna go see America, And what I did was going to go drive a truck. And my friends always tell me, Ernie, you driving a semi has to be the scariest thought in the world. So I saw America, and I could do 60 days on the road. I could go all over America driving, no cigarettes, no alcohol, no nothing. And it didn't bother me. But as soon as I was in New Jersey, I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and on our Qualcomm, it would come up, you're going home, head to California. And as soon as I saw that, this roaring animal would come roaring up on top of me. And it's all I could think about was getting to California. And I'm driving that truck, and my partner's looking at me, he's like, you're starting to scare me, Ernie. I'm like, you don't drive fast enough, just sit over there and go to sleep. And I'm driving all the way, you know, and I'm calling a friend that I'm going to come over. And he says, well, where are you? I said, I'm in Pittsburgh. He goes, Pennsylvania? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you're insane. But that monster, that mental obsession, you know, that grinding, not being able to get it out of your head, I was done. So, you know, this behavior, and I had been through treatment twice before, and I didn't pay attention to this book, and I didn't do what they suggested for me to do. And so this time around, my father dying in my arms of cancer said, son, everybody has done this in the family, why can't you stop? And I looked at him, and I, honest to God, from the bottom of my soul, said, I don't know why. Was this a man that would have given his life for me? He would have taken a bullet for me. And I didn't know why, how selfish I had become. My father passed, and my sister, and she looked at me and she said, Ernie, there's a new sheriff in town. And I was like, uh-oh. And so she showed up one day, and she said, Ernie, I know about the check. I know about the credit card. I know about everything. And so this is it, Ernie. I love you more than anything in the world, and I never want to see you again, ever. I'm going to want you to leave, and I never want you to come back. You're affecting my children. You're affecting my marriage. You're affecting everybody in our family. You cannot hear the tears that fall at night when you're out, and everybody is crying. Where's Ernie? We're tired of the business of the hospital. We're tired of the attorneys. We're done, Ernie. And I had a cousin that was next to her. And I raised him. He was an only child, and both his parents had passed away. And he really looked up to me, but now he's become successful. And my cousin John was standing there going, I'll take you anywhere. I'll take you anywhere right now. Just get in the car. Go. Come with me now. And I was like this. And so, and really when my sister was talking to me, I was like, it's over. So she said, you have a choice. There's the door. I'm going to give you some money. And I'm going to put a restraining order on you. You can't come around family. You can't come around mom. You can't come around. Or you can get some help. And we'll do this for you. One last time. So the next 24 hours later, I picked up the phone. And I called my sister. I said, Sia, I need some help. And she started crying. This person that wanted me to leave and never come back, she's crying on the phone and she says, my prayers have been answered. I found this wonderful facility. It's in Hunt, Texas. And you can go to Hunt, Texas. And you know, believe it or not, you know, I'm a server that plays bluegrass music. I play guitar. I play, you know, rather fast. And so my sister said, you can take your guitar and you can play all the George Strait you want. And I was like, yee-haw, let's go Cowboys. And so I called my cousin, who wanted me to go, come right now. And so I told him, I said, well, are you ready? He goes, I'll take you anywhere. I'm going to take you anywhere. I said, well, how much gas do you have? And he says, it doesn't matter. I'll take you anywhere you want to go. And he goes, where are we going to go? I said, San Antonio. And he said, Texas? And he said, yeah, Texas. And he goes, when's your plane leave? His circle of love had about a 20-mile radius. Where my sister was from here to heaven. She was going to give me my life back. And I get goosebumps because I call her every time I speak. Every time I do this, I call her and she goes, I know. I saved your life. And but you don't seem to realize, you know, the stories about my nieces when they were children waiting for me to give them swimming lessons, and they're on the porch and they're little with red swimsuit one piece, and they're 9 and 7, they're little fat toes, they're waiting for Uncle Andy, and they got the little swimming device. Well, where's he at? Well, he's on his way. Well, call him. Find out. And my sister has to take lunch out to them, and they wait. And my sister has to take dinner out there to them, and they wait until 8 o'clock at night, and they fell asleep, and my sister had to carry them into the bed to go to sleep. It wasn't until I was sober for quite a while, so my sister told me that had occurred. And I saw what I had done to my family. So, man, I was done. This place that I went to, they asked my sister, they said, is your brother done? And my sister said, my brother? He's never done. This guy can go on forever. He's like a cat. He's got 9 lives. But I came here not knowing what the answer was, because I really didn't delve into this book. But I was going to, because I had no choices. This is it, ladies and gentlemen. My family, I'm going to tell you, I came here with nothing. I had no friends, no family. I had no money, no job. I had no car. I had zeros across everything. So I was willing to do just about anything they told me to do. And so I got out of the car, I got out of the van, and I looked around, and I said to myself, wow, I have only myself to blame. Nobody else. Not that I came from a wonderful family. It's not that I had thousands of dollars at one time, a wonderful wife. I got only myself to blame. And I had this purpose in my life that I was going to do something different. And then this is what happened. I heard the message, not Ernie's message, not anybody else's message. I heard the message. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not my program, not anybody else's, the program that came out of the book. I ended up in a place where they talked about the book and the message that's in this book. And they talked about the first 164 pages of it, and they talked about the doctor's opinion. You know, and so I had this guy that was going to qualify me, and his name's Chris R. And he said to me, he said, hey, Ernie, have you ever tried to stop drinking and not been able to? And I said, yeah. He goes, when you drink, can you control it? And I'm like, no, sometimes I can, but I can't every time. And he said real lovingly, congratulations, Ernie, you're screwed. You have the disease of alcoholism. And one or two things are going to happen. You're either going to do this work and life's going to get really good, or your life will continue to spiral out of control. And because this is it, the disease, we know what this is about. It only wants us to, one or two things. The disease wants us to be living in misery or dead. And I know what misery's like. Seeing the faces of my mom. Seeing the faces that dark, dark hotel room that I'm alone, shivering near death. And so I qualify myself there at that moment that I'm an alcoholic. I addressed all these issues, and you had to look at Bill Wilson's story and identify all that. And I remember, I was raised in the Greek Orthodox Church, and I was an altar boy for 14 years, and I know I didn't know God. I had no idea who he was. I knew that he was in my life because he blessed my life a lot. But I remember rolling over in my bed and rolling over and crying out to God. I'm alone. And I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to need you. I cannot do this by myself. Please, please help me. And I don't remember going to sleep. I didn't have that sensation like, oh, I'm getting tired. I'm going to go to bed. I just remember waking up. And at that moment, I was changed. I was a changed man. And for some reason, I walked in with my head up and my chest out, and I was going to do whatever they told me to do. And it didn't matter if they told me to stand in the corner and stand on your hand. It didn't matter. Every time they told me to do something, I said the words yes. Because my way doesn't work. You know? It doesn't work. So I had this wonderful counselor, and she said, tell me about yourself, Ernie. And I said, my life is blessed. I came from a wonderful family. I have been pretty happy, you know, I have family for instruments, and I work in show business, and I come from a loving family. And she said, wow, you are blessed. You are absolutely blessed. So I said, thank you. She goes, okay, Mr. I think I'm blessed. She said, do you realize your sister's on the phone every morning with me crying her eyes out thinking that you're going to die? Do you realize this? Do you have any idea what you have done to your family? And again, once again, I had that feeling of that, oh my God, look what I've done to these people. So, you know, I got to do some work around the passing of my father. And, you know, I was pretty bottled up and I couldn't cry. I was unresolved, but we have to speak grief issues. And you know, she had me work on it yet. And, but I remember one time I had walked in and she said, as we all sat down, she said, oh, Ernie, it's your sister on the phone. And in front of everybody, she was going to hang me out to dry. And everybody, like, started moving away from me. This is not going to be good. And my sister was said, Ernie has the heart of gold. And she said, Ernie, your brother has the heart of gold and the mind of a criminal. And she said, my sister said, he'll give you the shirt off your back, off his back. And she said, of course he will. He stole it. It's not his shirt. Don't you understand who this guy is? And so she hung up. She said, how does that make you feel? And I was like, it doesn't make me feel like anything. It's the truth. And she said, you see what's happening here? For once in Ernie's life, he's taking ownership about who he is and what he's done. So, you know, I got out of there, and I immediately, you know, the very first thing I did, I got a sponsor, and because they told me to do it. And, you know, I started this work, and I did it at a four-step, and I had here I am, pretty happy guy, you know, kind of smiley guy, and they told me to write down the resentments. I wrote down 62 names in about 100 yards, because I was angry at the entire world. I wrote down everybody, teachers, coaches, ex-girlfriends, ex-wives, my business partners. I wrote down everybody. I wrote down Al Davis and the Oakland Raiders. They were always beating my charger. They cheat. My dress is still, and I couldn't do it. So I do all this, and I get the sponsor. And so he says to me, I said, hey, we're going to do a fifth step. And this is what happened. I started writing. There were four people, the girlfriend, the ex-wife, my partner, and I had to write down my part. That's the part that I can change. And so I have a resentment towards my ex-wife. My ex-wife are leaving me. And this is the truth, is that, you know, I can't be trusted that I'm lying and that I'm dishonest and I'm stealing. And I don't care about her feelings. I care only about myself and I'm self-centered. And I looked at that and went, oh my God, look what I've done to this person. And that resentment went away. And I felt sorry for her. And I looked at my girlfriend that left me, and I said, I can't be trusted. I'm stealing time. I don't care about her feelings. I try to get sober, and I can't. I'm stealing from her. And it was exactly the same thing. And instantly, once again, the resentment went away. Then I looked at my partner, my cousin, and, you know, I'm showing up late for work every day. I'm stealing money from the register, you know, stealing booze off the walls. I can't be trusted, and I'm like, God, these all sound the same. These are my character defects, so I'm looking at this, and once again, I felt sorry for him. And so I went to do this fifth step, and I called, got my sponsor, I said, hey, I'm ready to do my fifth step, and I had 80 handwritten pages, and you know, my handwriting, you can ask my boss, Rich Whitman, it kind of looks like six figures, and, you know, hieroglyphics going on. But I get handy, 80 handwritten pages in my, I go to get this done, and so my sponsor says to me, he goes, I can't do it for Sunday, we'll do it Monday. I'm like, okay. He says, I can't do it Monday, but we'll do it Wednesday. And I said, okay, I tell you what, you can do it Sunday, you can't do it Monday. If you don't show up on Wednesday, I'm going to fire you. Because I'm getting relief from every time I do a step. And so he's like, I'll be there. So I told him that I've done a lot of things I'm ashamed of. And, in my drinking, and he goes, well, let's just get through this, and we'll talk about it. So I got done, and he said to me, he said, well, where's the good stuff? And I said, well, that is the good stuff. He goes, now, let me tell you what I did. And right there, that's where they told me that you sit down and there's a mirrored image when you go to work with somebody, that someone's going to tell you my life. I was just telling my sponsor his life again. I said, he had done almost the exact same thing. You know, but, so as I'm doing this fifth step, I'm thinking that I've got this angel singing, and I've got this, I'm down by a waterfall off the Guadalupe. It's surreal. And I'm thinking, I'm so blessed to have this guy as a sponsor, you know. And then he spins around and he shows me my character defects and tells me the people I have to make amends to. And the first thing I think of, I made a terrible mistake. I've got the wrong guy. And so I did all that. I did everything that he told me to do, just like the people that started the journey. I just did the simple things that they told me to do, and my life continued to get better. And I made all those amends to all those people. And, you know, I can walk into those weddings with my head up and my family, all my family members. I can walk in with my head up and my chest out because I've done my part. I cleaned my side of the street. And that's the side I can take care of. And so, you know, in sobriety, you know, I can tell you that this is what it looked like. I went to make an amends, and people that have heard my story, it's a key point of my story, is that we're looking for that spiritual experience. So I called a cousin of mine that was very close to me, and I said, Pete, I am alone, I'm 50 years old, I'm living in a halfway house, these guys are half my age, and I said, hey, Pete, I need to tell you that, you know, I wasn't thinking of you, and I need to make amends. And he goes, you need to shut up. I have heard this stuff come out of your mouth so many times, and I'm sick of it. And everybody else in the family, they need to be happy, but they're happy because you're 1,200 miles away. But you can enjoy Texas, and I understand you found God. And he hung up, and that was it. And I was the best man in his wedding. We ran around the Colorado River together. And, and then it happened. I said to myself, I had lied to him many times. And what he said was the honest to God truth. In the core of my being, I am a sensitive little flower. And he hurt my feelings. And I didn't want to use. I didn't want to drink. I was a free man, alone in a halfway house, by myself, sitting on my bed, with this book in my hand. I was free. And I don't know how it happened. There was, I had some wonderful things happen to me. They told me my life was going to get a lot better. And so I immediately, since I worked in the grocery industry, the very first thing I did was go get a job. So I got a job at a company, a very large grocery firm here in Texas. It starts with an H, ends with a B. I went from working with the most prestigious studios in Hollywood, some of the biggest stars, to bagging groceries. And they told me that my life was going to get better. And it was. And so what happened was, they started, and I didn't go in there and say, hey, guess what, I used to work in the liquor store, I had a liquor store, I used to steal money out of the cash register. I didn't do that, you know. They said, there's something different about this guy. This guy shows up an hour early every day, he does the simple things we want him to do. There's something wrong. We're going to keep an eye on this guy. Because he's up to something. So I had some shoulder surgery, and they told me, we don't want to let you go, Ernie. We want you to just come back and walk around and talk to the customers, because basically that's really all you do. And so I'm walking around, and I'm talking to these people, and then I was going to go back to California, and they told me, you're going to come back to the store. And I said, okay, what's going on? And they said, they're going to give you a different job. And I'm like, what's that? And they said, well, go talk to the director. And I said, okay. So I go to the director, and I said, well, are you going to put me on the schedule again to be the roving goodwill ambassador? He goes, oh, no, we're going to make you a manager. And I'm like, a manager of what? He said, of the whole store. I had been there less than a year. I was bagging groceries. And they're going to make me a manager, the four key manager. I was going to be the lowest one, but I was going to have my picture up there. And so there I am. They get around me, and these people, this one guy, Charlie, he's been there 27 years. He says, I'm still in the food department. How the hell did this happen? And I'm like, I don't know how it happened. It's as if somebody is puppeteering my life. Somebody from above is puppeteering the people around him. It's like that Jedi Force, make him a manager. Yeah, make him a manager. And so this is the craziest thing. They're going to give me the highest security that there is. They're going to do that FBI clearance. They're going to do all this other stuff that other managers who have been there for years don't have. And this is how why God has a sense of humor. The very first thing that they put me in charge of was this. Shipping and receiving of all alcoholic products. I was in charge of meeting the Brink payroll and holding, $180,000 in cash in my hand, and the pharmacy. And you got to tell me right there, does God have a sense of humor or what? Now, it is 3 o'clock in the morning. I am by myself. I am surrounded by thousands and thousands of cases of beer. And hell, come on, you don't care if it's warm. I don't care if there's a cigarette float in it. It kind of gives it that woodsy taste. Fresh brewed. And I am sitting on a pallet of thousands of Vicodin and Oxycontin and Xanax. And I'm holding $180,000 in cash in my lap. And I'm thinking, my life is weird. Because did I ever think about drinking any alcohol? No. Did I ever think about popping a seal and taking some Xanax or anything else? No. Did I ever think about taking that money and going to Mexico? Well, yeah. That's a program of honesty. But me wearing a dress in a Mexican jail just doesn't sound like it. And that's the truth. I don't look good in public. So I play this through, and my life just continues to change. And I mean, I'm just so blessed. And so, how am I doing on time? I have about it. And so my life continues to change, and I get to have a 4-step experience around working there where I started to have butt heads with a manager, and he was going to crawl up my teacher, and he wasn't going to let go. And I'm like, what's my part? Well, I choose to work here. I signed up. I took all the applications. I get a paycheck release. If you want to sign up for that ministry, you want to keep signing up. Or do something else like check Prescott. And so I had this opportunity to go to work doing medical reviews in the HR department. Now, this guy says, hey, you can do this because all you need to do is talk. And I'm like, don't you need to be a doctor? Don't you need to be a nurse or something? He goes, yeah, but you don't need that. You can talk. And so I did this interview with this doctor, and he said, it was going to be 15 minutes, and we talked for 2 hours and 15 minutes, and all we talked about was one thing. We talked about God, and we talked about recovery, and we talked about this book. And I said, hey, so do I get this job? And he said, well, he goes, tell me one thing, buddy. In the last 3 years, how much work have you missed? I said, I've missed one day of work. He said, you've missed one day of work in 3 years? I said, like, but you're hired. I don't care if you can't even speak English. You're hired. Just show up. We'll teach you what to do. And so I'm driving to work the very first day, and I've got my shirt on and my little stockers, and I'm all pressed and ready to go. Pants, lightly starched. And I'm going there, and I'm thinking to myself, I am perfect for this job. God made me for this job. Nobody can do this better than me. I am absolutely I am in God's hands. Okay? And there's this part over here. Then I drive exactly 1/4 mile, 1,320 feet, and the voice in my head says, Ernie, you suck. You suck. I know you suck. You know you suck. These people are going to find out you suck. And then you're going to be fired and employed because you suck. And I'm like, oh my God, where's this voice? I'm either thinking that I'm Superman, this inflated ego that this book talks about, or that I think I'm the worst, filled with guilt and shame, and I have no self-esteem. And where I am, what this program does, it keeps me from this inflated ego, it keeps me from this crippling disease of low self-esteem and depression. And in some way, when my prayers in this program and these beautiful people that are here today, it keeps me really centered and finds me someplace in the middle. But I'm not the greatest in the world. I'm not the center of the universe, and I definitely don't suck. So the great thing is that I continue to move on, and I had a great opportunity because of a wonderful man who's here today, Mr. Rich Whitman. He often, I started having problems, and I said, am I ever going to go and work at this facility for you? And he said, the very next day when I asked a friend, the very next day Rich called me, and I get to go to work, and I get to carry the message in all kinds of different ways. They called me out there to work with people and do fifth steps. And they called me out there, and I got guys that I sponsored. And I can tell you that, and there's just a miracle of this program. I just don't understand how it works. I remember that they called me out there to go work with a person. And I mean, what do I have to offer somebody? And a friend of mine said, Ernie, you think you're going to keep them sober? You don't have the power to keep yourself sober. So tell them how you did the work. Tell them how you fostered a relationship with a power of a greater than yourself, or whatever it may be. And they told me to go out there, and I'm like, okay, fine. And so I go out there, and they tell me this guy's a teacher. So I said, okay, you're a teacher. I walked out there, and there's a man in his mid-60s, late-60s, and I said, Robert. He said, you can call me Bob. I said, okay, Bob, I understand you're a teacher. He said, well, no, not really. I said, well, so what are you? He says, well, I'm a professor. I have a doctorate in chemistry. I have a doctorate in physics. And I teach solar phenomena at UC Berkeley. And the first thing I thought of, start using big words. I want to sound smart. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, I've got my own rocket scientist. And so I start using things like this. Theoretically speaking, Bob, in theory of, and he looks at me like, what are you talking about? And you know what the most thing? He said this. Here's this man, brilliantly smart, IQ off the charts. And why these people thought I had something in common with this guy, he did. He said to me, Ernie, I have read hundreds of books on this. I know friends of mine that have dove and dissected the brain and how it works. And I wanted to talk about pi. I wanted to talk about the Pythagorean theory. I wanted to talk about all this neat stuff, the Big Bang theory, because I got the guy that has the answer. And the only thing he wanted to talk about was, Ernie, how in God's name did you get sober? Because I can't stay sober. And I thought I could outthink this, and I can't think how faint this would be. And I thought to myself, well, I can show you, Bob. I'm going to show you exactly what they did. I had my experience of sitting there and having Chris R. and Rich W. and these people carry this message to me out of this book. Here in the doctor's opinion, and I just want to read this real quick. It says, after they have succumbed to desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of spree and emerge remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over again. Unless they can have experience an entire psychic change, there is little chance of their recovery. And I heard Rich Whitman say that to me, and I heard him on the second day I was there. And so I remembered that. I didn't know what I was going to say to Bob. So I read him the doctor's opinion. I said, you identify with that? He goes, man, that's my story. That's it. So we I was able to, from this book and from what people had shown me and drew me with a vision, that my life was going to get better. Because if I was going to be sober and miserable, I'm not getting sober. They promised me. They made promises to me that my life was going to get better, a lot better. And I just had to hang on. So with Bob, we do a fist stick. At the end of it, I'm standing behind him, holding his shoulders. And I said, Bob, do you understand that when you go to work with another, do you understand that God is here with us today? And do you understand that he's going to be here with you when you go to work with another individual? He said, yeah. I said, Bob, it wasn't very convincing. Do you believe that he's going to be here for you when you go to work with another person? He goes, yes, I do. And in the middle of August, out of nowhere, it's 104 degrees, the wind goes, and this cool breeze blew and blew all the leaves off the ground. And Bob goes, oh, my God, what's that? And I'm like, that's God. I mean, Spielberg couldn't have done it with an electric fan. I've been there. They don't do it. Hey, two, get the leaves back out there. Let's go there. They can't do it. And I was changed. Bob was changed. I can tell you the chair. I can show you the oak tree I was at. I got this crazy memory that I remember all these wonderful things. You know, I have this wonderful, wonderful opportunity that I get to travel. And, I got to go to Scotland in April and carry this message and speak to a bunch of people that you can't understand what they're saying. You know, but they shake their fists at you and they say, brilliant, brilliant, you know. But they talked about the same thing. They talked about the phenomenon. They're just like ourselves, identical, you know. But this is the crazy thing is that I go to walk in, and the friend I'm working with, Chris R., he goes up and they separate. So you go there and you go there. We're going to customs trying to get into the UK. And they ask Chris, what are you here for? He goes, I'm here to speak at a convention. The guy goes, come in. And so he comes up, the guy comes to me, and he says, what are you here for? I'm here to speak at a convention. Where? I don't know. Well, who are you here to? How are you going to get to the convention? I don't know. What are you going to say? I don't know. Well, how are you going to get to the hotel? I don't know. Who are you going to meet? I don't know. And I can feel like the laser, the sight from the 300 Magnum, you know, as the security guards are coming towards me, you know. And so he goes, let me get this straight. You come here to speak at a convention. You don't know where it's at. You don't know where you're speaking. You don't know how you're getting there. You don't know that hotel, and you don't know why you're here. And the only really answer I had that was the truth, I wanted to tell him, the only reason why I'm here, I'm an alcoholic. I'm here to carry the message, and anybody can get sober. No matter how far down the scale you've gone, it says that in the book. It's the greatest of all gifts that, you know, we can get sober and we can help somebody else. Yeah. There is, the great thing is that I get to go back to a family that loves me. I get to go back to a family that wants to see me. I get to go to those big fat Greek weddings where everybody's dancing. And a gentleman will come up to my sister, a man that there's 450 people at the Biltmore Hotel. And there's this gentleman that I've known my whole life and I've never said a word to, but I know who he is. And whispers or something, my sister looks over at me like this. And this man comes up to me and I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. He's going to say, hi, you're Ernie, and you're Thea's brother. You're the one that lives in Texas. And I'm like, yeah. And he says, and I know what's coming. He's going to say, I have a nephew. I have a sister. I'm worried about my brother. And my life takes on a whole different meaning. I'm not there for the wedding, the cake, everybody there. I'm not there for the bride or anything else. I'm there to be of service to the fellowship of to reach out to the people that need me and need our help. You know, I'm going to kind of wind this down. And I'm going to tell you from the bottom of my heart that this is what I truly believe. It really doesn't matter. For the new people in here, if you haven't been sober very long, I'm going to tell you. And the old timers that are here, I'm preaching to the choir. But the truth is this, that if you're in this room today, on this day, and you have a pulse, and you are breathing, then you have a mission in life. You have been given a gift. that there's somebody that's going to need you today, tomorrow, somewhere down the line. You can be in this fellowship and they're an alcoholic. You can change people's lives. And that's the reality of this disease. I thought I could never do the things that I could do. I've been all over the world. I've stood at the Acropolis sober. I've stood in the footprints of Socrates. I've been back and forth to a family. I've been hunting, fishing. I've been in the casinos of Lake Tahoe, where the cocktails are free. And the greatest thing I do is a free man. Free at last. I just want to thank you guys all so very, very much for coming today, and I love you all very, very much. Thank you.